Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
In 2014, the city of Hong Kong was shaken by the brutal attacks and murders of 2 sex workers, one of the worst cases its criminal justice system has literally ever dealt with. Even more shocking, the killings had been carried out by a wealthy US investment banker, a sexual predator literally of the highest order. He'd found somewhere overseas where he could play out his dark fantasies with deadly consequences, believing that he could get away with it. This is what happens when a narcissistic, sadistic, sexual psychopath uses his Western wealth to exploit the vulnerable. This is the case of Rurik Jutting. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi guys, thanks for joining me. Today's case is one a lot of you have probably heard of. Also, I've had so many requests for this case, and I know it because it's one of those cases that was quite profound at the time and also stuck out just because of the sadistic level of the murders, but also because I get asked to comment a lot on these kind of things in the media, and I have done. And I guess that I resisted doing it for a while because it has been covered quite a lot. And whenever I cover things, I need to be able to add value to it. I just don't want to regurgitate the same stuff that the creators have done or the documentaries have shown. So it's taken quite a while to find those additions to the information. But the consequences, hopefully, I'm going to do the victims justice and also highlight the kind of predators that exist, and also that very much go in line with my belief system. Got to think about narcissistic psychopaths in a different way these days. They know about technological advancements. They know about the fact that in the Western world, there's a real thirst for justice. And I absolutely know that if people disappear of meaning, there are going to be questions asked. But is it the same in countries elsewhere? And the likelihood is absolutely not. The Western pound and dollar can be spent in a range of ways, in the most malevolent of ways, in certain places. And there's almost a supportive network around that that makes this possible. So let's start where I suppose it always begins. So Rurik George Catton Jutting, I kid you not, that's his name. We already know that we're dealing with middle class or aristocracy when we have a name like that. Rurik George Catton Jutting. So he's born in March 1985. He had a really privileged upbringing. You may have realised that from the name. So he's raised in Chobham, Surrey, England. And that is a very expensive, well-to-do place. You are well-heeled if you have been born to parents in that area. His father was an engineer, that's Graham, and his mother, Helen. She ran an American-style milkshake bar franchise, so a successful family, and his younger brother, Oren. Now, he grows up in a grade 2 listed manor house. For those of you who are not quintessentially British, you probably won't know what that means, but basically, in the UK, if you have a grade 2 listed manor house, there are different grades of it, becoming more and more complex as you get to the lower figures because of the fact that you have to keep the house looking in a certain way that's in keeping with its history. So the architecture, etc., has to be managed in an appropriate level. And if you want changes, let's say you want double glazing, it's probably not going to happen, because the windows won't look correct for the date of the original house and structure. So you can imagine that if you move somewhere like that, on the whole, you're gonna have a little bit of money. The property itself, you will not believe this, was actually inspiration for illustrations of Toad Hall in Wind of the Willows. That's right, Toad Hall. Literally, my childhood described right there. And that house is what the author was literally looking at and being motivated by. That's how beautiful it was. Now, according to the neighbours, they said, look, as a family, there was no problems. They were people who liked to keep themselves to themselves. They certainly weren't raucous. There were no issues. They weren't conflictual. They weren't people who stood out. So essentially, we're looking at what could be described as an archetypal, normal British family who are very well-to-do. Also, his parents are very invested in their children. They spared literally no expense in his education. He attended Wallop Independent Primary School in Weybridge. Not convinced by the name Wallop. When I was growing up, if you walloped somebody, basically meant you punched them in the face. But nevertheless, Wallop Independent Primary School in Weybridge. And then he moved on to Abberley Hall Boarding School in Worcestershire. Beautiful area of the country. And again, the fact that he's going to boarding school is incredibly expensive. But I think that psychologically, we also have to acknowledge when a child is sent to boarding school, and particularly in the middle and upper classes in the UK, and when I'm referring to middle, I'm not talking about middle as in working middle class, I'm talking about middle, very wealthy opportunities that people like me could only dream of. Often there is a traditional route where children are concerned, and sending them to boarding school is seen as a real privilege. But having worked in child development and having seen some of the emotional disconnect that that causes, it can actually affect a developing brain pretty enormously. And I know that people don't want to talk about that because, like I said, privilege and problems with development probably aren't seen as going hand in hand. But it can be a very alienating, abandoning and isolating experience for children. And whether this is a contributor to the case that I'm going to talk about today, well, I'll let you make the decisions there. But certainly, I think it's worth noting. Now, Jutting himself, really able, really capable, very, very gifted student. And actually, his IQ was established to be 137. That puts him in the top 1% of the population. So he's a very bright cookie. He's not a genius, but he can hold his own academically. He actually secured a scholarship and was privately educated in further education at the prestigious Winchester College. So he isn't just bright, he is super bright, and super bright to the point where they're happy to literally pay for his place as a college because he stands out so effectively. Now, that college scholarship was 34K a year. That's a lot of money that they're investing, and they're doing it because he's obviously incredibly bright. His classmates said it was obvious from the beginning that he was incredibly sharp, he was incredibly bright, but he wasn't somebody that they really wanted to spend time with. So there was something about him that was instinctually and on an intuition level making other young people feel either wary of him or that he wasn't somebody that they could easily connect with. So after he graduates, it's not a surprise to see that he ends up at Cambridge's University's Peterhouse College. Now, if you are not au fait with the UK, when you are 18, if you are incredibly bright, you'll be encouraged to go for the Oxbridge examinations. That's Oxford and Cambridge. And to get in to those institutions is incredibly difficult. And namely, part of that reason is because of the fact that there are so many privately educated and high level education orientated places that kind of feed in to the places that exist. So you've got Eton, for example. These are places that it's almost a stepping stone. That's where you go, Oxford or Cambridge. But if you don't go to those colleges, it can be much more difficult. Nonetheless, he just goes straight there because obviously he's incredibly bright. He's been to boarding school. He's gone to a prestigious college. He fits the absolute stepping stones that we expect to see. And he studies history and law. He's actually a member of the rowing club. He was also a secretary of the Undergraduate History Society. So even though at college people are saying that they didn't really want to hang around with him, obviously he knows how to integrate and he's somebody who likes a bit of responsibility. But we all know that some people like positions of power for a completely separate reason than just being a pro-social little cookie. Now, according to the people who knew him there, they said he was quite reserved. He wasn't one of the lads. Apparently he was difficult around girls, he was quite awkward around girls, but still, in spite of this, he kind of had this confident air. And even though there was this awkwardness around the college girls and university girls that he'd been around, he actually started to become relatively popular with women. Maybe it was the fact that he just had that confidence, or that he was incredibly intellectual, or that he was an individual who did get engaged in all of these other opportunities like rowing. Just sounds so middle class, as it's rowing. Rowing down the Thames, as you do with your other incredibly wealthy friends. But he has a total of 9 relationships. So it's not hard for him to pick up a new one when one ends. But also, let's highlight the fact that they do end. And often, if you're going through an enormous amount of relationships, it says something about the eagerness and ease with which you pick them up, but the problems that you have in sustaining them. Now, I'm not saying for one minute that he's an individual who couldn't sustain a relationship in a way that didn't cause some concern. I'm just noting that that is quite a lot of people to go through. Now, after he graduates from Cambridge, he basically goes into a classic career of investment banking. Again, there is a real route for these kind of individuals, and it's really unsurprising that he follows that. So he goes into investment banking, he works for a short stint at Barclays, but then he actually secures a position with the Bank of America Merrill Lynch in 2010. He does that in their London offices, so he's not actually in the States, but he's in the London offices. And it's one of those scenarios that means that he's instantly in a position of success. That bank is now known as the Bank of America Securities, and it's a really big deal. So it's a multinational investment banking division. And to all intents and purposes, he did really well at his job. And he was doing so well, in fact, that in 2013, he gets transferred to the bank's office in Hong Kong. And here he's working as an equities and commodities trader. And his life takes on, I suppose, something that very few of us could even anticipate dreaming of. So he moves into a £4,000 a month luxury apartment at 60 Johnston Road. Now, this is in a really busy commercial area of Wan Chai. Jutting's grandfather, just so you know, Paul Smith, he had actually been a decorated superintendent within the Hong Kong police. And it feels like he's following in those very successful footsteps. You know, he's kind of treading the same line, because here we have a really young, successful, intelligent man, and his salary was huge. £350,000 a year. I appreciate that he's been brought up with the privilege that he's actually experienced, so it probably doesn't seem quite as enormous to him as it does to us. £350,000? It's like the average person's wage 10 years added up. So it feels like he has the world at his feet. But it feels like ultimately the move to Hong Kong, it unleashes something. So the move overseas sees his life start to spiral out of control. And again, one could say, well, you know, it's the first time legitimately that he's been completely by himself. You know, at boarding school, he would have had peers. They're all English speaking. His family would be available to him if he wants to see them. When he's working in London at the banks, again, he'll have connections and contact with people close to him. And to some degree, it can mediate your behaviour. But when you are completely alone, you have access to a huge amount of money, and also access potentially to opportunities that aren't necessarily good for you, then you can begin to see these kind of spiraling behaviours occur. Down the line, Jutting actually will be diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. And when they explored his history to look at the first signs of when these red flags began, they said that around 11 years of age, it became quite notable. There was something in his personality that maybe wasn't contextual and in line with his peers. So even he himself said, look, when I was a kid, there was a moment where my mum congratulated me because I got entry to Winchester College, and she was thrilled. And all I felt was resentment and anger and insult that she could not have just accepted that, of course, I'd get a place. He saw it as an insult that she was saying, well done. Because as far as he was concerned, it was obvious he was always going to end up there. Now, if we look at that just on a layman's level, it means that we've got highly arrogant personality traits. This is an individual who's going through life with a superiority complex. He thinks he is special, even from a really early age. He thinks he's better than everyone else around him. And it's quite ironic because the Russian origin of his name meant famous ruler. May have taken that a little bit to heart. Gonna be honest when it comes down to describing the kind of malevolence this individual is capable for. And whilst he's been going through the years at boarding school, college, university, it seems that he has been developing a darker side to his nature. First of all, he got into really quite hardcore pornography when he was at school, and he watched vast amounts of it. And he'd actually developed this predilection for violent pornography. So he's particularly into pornography that depicted rape and torture of women, which, as far as I am concerned, should not even be legal and legitimate to have out there. The idea that any of that content is acceptable is, as far as I'm concerned, completely unethical, but it exists. And also, it's worth noting that even people like Ted Bundy noted that he felt that as an individual developing the kind of dark side that he had, pornography was a real prompt for him, a real trigger for him, a real tipping off point in his development of the killings that we saw play out and the crimes that he committed. So whenever you see these kind of connections, particularly in adolescence, of such a high grade and level, it should give you an alarm bell. And also what we see in therapeutic intervention, and believe me, because I've worked in it, and I've worked with men who cannot get hard-ons at all unless they are dealing with deep sadism. And of course, they then fall in love with somebody who's just got much more vanilla taste and they can't even have sex. We have to go through a whole period of desensitization therapy to stop them, grade by grade, needing that kind of material or needing those kind of actions to have a sexual relationship at all. It certainly has an impact. And instead of him realizing, look, maybe I need to temper this behavior, you know, maybe I need to consider the fact that this isn't going to be good for me or my partners in the future, it doesn't. He just starts to play it out with his girlfriends. So he wants them to act submissively during sex. He really enjoyed rough sex. Also really starts to develop this sexual sadism connection and taste. And to some degree, there will be people listening to this who will be involved in the S&M community. It will be a kink. You'll be consenting to that kink. It will be something you enjoy. And at the end of the day, whatever works for you in your relationships works. But again, we have to be aware that where sexual sadism is concerned, the boundaries can be pushed. People don't necessarily always find themselves in the safest of situations when they're involved with a partner like this. And like I said, submission is something that certain people enjoy, but if you were not ready for this kind of thing in your life, or it isn't your kind of kink and your partner wants it, it can be really scary because we stretch boundaries for our partner when we're falling in love, and sometimes that can place us in circumstances that are not positive for us. Now, he believes that the reason that he developed some of these urgencies within his sexual behavior is because he had two particular notable instances in his life. First of all, he said that when he was at college, he was sexually abused, so he was forced to give another male student oral sex, which would be incredibly traumatic, beyond a shadow of a doubt. And also at 16, he said that he'd witnessed his father attempt to take his own life by slashing his wrist, which would be unbelievably traumatic, and I imagine it would be a transcending experience. I'm not necessarily convinced that those experiences are going to create a sexual sadist. To some degree, I would argue that we'd expect to see completely opposite behavior. We'd see more compassionate and more sympathetic, more sensitive, and even more restrained behavior, because you note the impact that distress can have on other human beings and you would wish to prevent that. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. So we know and have a complete empathy for the fact this would significantly impact him, but I find it difficult to twist myself into a position where I can hear what he's saying, as far as suggesting that this is something that prompted him to develop the predilections that he's developing. Also, as you'll expect, the fact that he gets a diagnosis of narcissism down the line, it won't be a surprise that he's somebody who literally cannot accept or take responsibility for any failure. So if, for example, he graduates from Cambridge with a second class honours degree in law, and for somebody who has thrived academically and has never struggled and hasn't had to work that hard to stand out, suddenly he's found himself with a second class honours degree, which is a perfectly admirable degree and people are very happy with the second class honours, but he's going to want a first. He's going to be the one who wants to stand out most. And he literally psychologically would not accept that it was his true grade. He just would not believe that he was the person who would have received a second class honours degree. He said that his examiners had been too stupid to understand him. I should have figured that one out as an excuse in my A-levels. How did you do in your A-levels then? Well, I mean, you know, obviously I've got the grades that they've given me, but they're not right. Why are they not right? Well, basically, I'm so clever that when I wrote my essays, they could not understand me because I'm so intellectually above them. Couldn't it just be that you wrote about the wrong Queen Mary when you were doing your A-level history? It was the right Queen Mary intellectually. And it was the fact that they were asking for the wrong Queen Mary that proves my point. Yeah, so basically that's how he manages it. It's all their fault. It's nothing to do with him. They're just too stupid to understand him. You know, he's unable to do that internal gazing, to acknowledge the fact that he needs to be responsible and accountable for his actions. But this narcissistic personality, when you combine it with a natural intellect, up until that point, it served him really well through life. So it would be a blow. And narcissists hate it when the power's taken away from them. He'd succeeded academically. And in spite of the fact that he doesn't get his first class degree at Cambridge, he knows that he has the qualities and opportunities to succeed professionally. Because whatever Jutting wants, he gets. But the thing about that kind of personality is it can go two ways. You know, you can be a relatively cutthroat professional. You can be an individual who has mass ambition and you can work, succeed. Or to some degree, it can go the other way, where the developing predilections within you, accompanied with the opportunities and privileges that your life presents, added to the personality and character flaws that you have within you, leaves you open to possibilities some of us could never conceive. Because money can buy a great deal, and sometimes it can cause us to think that we have an entitlement to situations that no one should ever have an entitlement to. Just think about all those weirdos who go to Thailand and the Philippines for 2-week holidays where they're literally going to sexually exploit people. They exist, they have the access to the funds, and unfortunately they have a supportive quality around them who made these things possible. Now, when you think about investment banking, which is what he's in, that is absolutely synonymous with fast living. Any of you who know traders, any of you know bankers, you are going to be aware that these individuals can get, for a bonus, more than most of us get in a lifetime, genuinely, of wages. It's insane. The people who operate in that particular world, they tend to be renowned for their expensive tastes, for their predilections of debauchery and hedonism and self-indulgence, because they can and they do. They have access, so they use their access. And when Jutting gets to Hong Kong, it's like he discovers his other side to himself. I say discovers another side to himself, but probably is better said that the side of himself that he has to some degree managed to keep under wraps, it hasn't been too damaging, he allows to fully come out. So the hedonistic side of his nature is something that he just massively embraces. And with his Western wealth, he can just take full advantage of everything that his new home has to offer. But this includes class A drugs, it includes prostitution, sex work. And the thing about his apartment is it isn't very far away from the red light district. And before he came to Hong Kong, he had been frequenting using sex workers back in London. So when he gets to Hong Kong and the culture there to some degree is more open, I would say, around accessibility to these women, because you have a lot of women coming from very poor countries trying to create a life for themselves, send money home. It means that there is more levels of vulnerability for some of those women. So it kind of kicks into overdrive. He'd have sex with two or three sex workers at a time. Also, he starts to really focus on the fantasy of rough sex, starts pushing it further and further and further. And he's having all of these drug-fueled sex parties in his apartment that apparently lasted days. Also, he has a what I would say is a voracious sexual appetite. So he's having sex with women, he's having sex with men, he's having sex with transsexuals. I suppose one could argue that he is a heavy extreme of pansexuality, as in he just likes sex with anybody who's essentially he's attracted to. And he had typologies of the individuals that he was really attracted to. So he'd use the Grindr app, for example, to look for gay black men to have sex with. Always makes me feel a little bit Dahmer-ish when I hear sentences like that, you know? It's an individual who's going for a very specific type, and even though he's literally having sex with people across the board, just noting that in the research, it made me go, oh, that's very much more wacky cannibal, isn't it? Now, down the line, he'd later tell a psychiatrist, I was trying to do everything I could to get new experiences, but I always ended up disappointed. It's really intriguing, isn't it? This is a man who's pushing the boundaries more and more. He's trying to feed whatever it is within himself to connect with a deeper experience. And even though he's got all of this in fantasy, when it plays out in actuality, it just isn't giving him the kicks that he wants it to give him. So with this very sex-fueled mindset, he's making trips to sex districts in Angeles City, Manila, the Philippines, which is somewhere that he goes because he wants to have sex with younger women. And I can't identify that he was having sex with very young children, for example, but the fact that he's going to the Philippines really concerns me, because there is so much sexual exploitation of children there, and your Western dollar can get a lot for your money. It's offensive to my sensibilities, but I think it's worth noting. Also, he has this really, really macabre fantasy. So he thinks that somewhere in the future, he's going to return to the UK, and then he's going to kidnap multiple private school teenagers and use them as sex slaves. And they found a video later down the line on his mobile, and he said this: they would be, say, 15 years old, and I'd basically turn three of these girls into my sex slaves. It would be good psychologically to play them off against each other. So you can see that what he's thinking about there isn't just the physical torture of these girls and the terror they'd be put through, it's the manipulation that he could use against them and against each other, so to speak, by using that in such a way that is going to make them feel that they can turn on one another. So you're looking at power play in so many different dimensions there. He also decided that it'd be good if he took a young mother, because then he's got the additional collateral of being able to threaten her child so that she'd have to do what he wanted, because otherwise the consequences would be terrible for the kid. Again, that's such power play, isn't it? It's not just about the physical domination, because hey, if you've been kidnapped by somebody, you're within their power anyway. The fact that he wants to then use other targets to further exploit them psychologically, it means that he's thought out how to torture somebody on a range of levels. It isn't just the physical, it isn't just the sadism, it isn't just the sexual, it's all to do with that multifold opportunity to really distress another human being, to distress another female. Now, before long, I would say there is a sliding doors moment where the career that obviously he's been focusing on for a very long time just dissolves into the background. And instead, he starts to really concentrate on this necessary satisfaction of his depraved cravings. They're starting to overwhelm him. And he's nurturing that narcissistic, psychopathic, sexual sadism side. And everything he's doing, think about the drugs that he's putting in his body, how that can affect the brain. Think about the alcohol that he's drinking, because boy, this guy drinks alcohol. Again, that's going to impact on his brain. Think about the constant sex and the turnover of different women, men, etc. This is giving him an idea of superiority and access that he didn't have in the UK. And so he's starting to focus all of his attentions in that area. And as the months passed, he becomes more and more addicted to cocaine. Apparently, he was able to get industrial quantities of the drug from a dealer contact. He's drinking vast amounts of alcohol. In fact, when they looked at his intake, he was taking the equivalent of 3 uncut grams of cocaine a day. Now, bear that in mind, uncut grams, as in pure, because obviously by the time it gets on the street, it's got things like, I don't know, baby laxative in it and icing sugar and various cleaning products that mimic the sourness, for example, of cocaine. But we're talking 3 uncut grams of cocaine a day, so pure. Also, add to that a day, 4 bottles of wine and spirits. Literally, I'd be dead after even trying to ingest a third of what's just been discussed. And a toxicology expert would later state that this was enough to put a normal person in a coma. Did we really need a toxicology expert for that? I appreciate in court they probably do. They can't just have somebody on the street going, mate, that is too much. My mate drank 2 bottles of cider and had a spliff and was hospitalized. You know, it's not okay, is it? They need to get an expert. But I mean, if anybody is like, how much did you drink? I drank like 3 bottles of wine, bottle of Jack Daniels, and I had 3 uncut grams of cocaine a day. You'd be like, literally, you are pickled. It's as simple as that. You will probably not decay when you die because you have somehow put so much into your body that your body will just not decompose because essentially you have transferred all of your blood and organs for just drugs and alcohol. You've pickled yourself. We don't need any of the things that we put into the body to make them remain in a certain state when people are visiting the coffin because this individual has taken care of it. Forget the formaldehyde, kids. Forget it. Anyway, huge amount. You can imagine the impact that's having on the brain and body. And Judson basically builds up a tolerance for this, and he can operate this way, which is astonishing. Think about this. He's balancing this addiction that I've just described with working 16-hour days. 16-hour days. And after he was binging on the alcohol, etc., he'd used amphetamines to just get himself back into check. And anybody who's taking cocaine, you'll be aware that if you take cocaine and then you drink alcohol, you can drink a lot more alcohol than you would normally be able to. And then as you start to come down and crash, you just take more cocaine. That lifts you up, and it means that you can maintain a certain lifestyle and appear sometimes to other people to be in control, even when you're actually completely out of control physiologically. Now, we have a really unhealthy lifestyle going on here. Also, his diet's terrible. He's a really unhealthy diet. He lived on takeaways, he lived on energy drinks, and his weight just shoots up. Of course, it does. So he puts on a huge amount of weight. And by the latter half of 2014, we see a real decline in his work. So he's gone from working 16 hours days, he's gone from being very successful. Remember, he's on a huge wage, but he's absent more and more and more. And it actually got so bad in the end that he said to the company that he tested positive for HIV. Now, that's a clever manipulation tactic. Who's going to feel comfortable saying, well, you're sacked? Because it's got to be completely understood that if somebody tests positive for HIV, they're going to need some extra care and attention. Psychologically, it's going to be really challenging for them to get used to that. And the consequence of that is your employer should be there to be at least protective around what's happening to you and have understanding about your absences. But he's doing this because he knows that. Again, he's playing that card because he understands that this is going to give him the best opportunity to get away with this behavior. Now, ultimately, it gets to the point where in October 2014, he hands in his resignation. And it's like he does that for one specific reason, and that's to just focus full time on his hedonism and on his insatiable sexual sadism, essentially. And during the 2 years that he's in Hong Kong, he actually spent around £650,000 on sex and drugs. I mean, I know that rock bands do have a little bit of a penchant for the old sex and drugs, but even I believe that the vast majority of people, even in the category of Ozzy Osbourne, would struggle to spend £650,000 on sex and drugs in 2 years. It's astronomical. And it's got to be a full-time job, hasn't it? That's got to be a full-time commitment. Now, during this period of time, we know that his dark predilections are growing more and more. And sadly, this leads to what we're going to talk about today, which is two sex workers who have the horrible misfortune to cross Jutting's path. One of them is 23-year-old Sumarti Ningsi from Indonesia, and the other one is 30-year-old Seneng Mudjasi. She's also known as Jessie Lorena, and she's originally from the Philippines. Now, both of those women had grown up in poverty, so they traveled to Hong Kong with one reality in the back of their mind, that they want to make money. They want to provide a better life for their families back home. Sumarti, she actually had a five-year-old son, and she was regularly sending money back to help fund his education. That was her main priority. And of course, both of the women had essentially arrived in Hong Kong on work visas, because the initial plan was they were going to find work as domestic helpers. But like so many young girls and women from impoverished countries, when they're seeking a better life, they want to make as much money as possible. And unfortunately, that means that they can often fall into sex work. It's not because they want to do it. It's just that it achieves a goal. It achieves a possibility for their families that they're not going to have a difficult life compared to the one that they were having before you start sending that money home. And that's the incentive. And that's why these women find themselves in this situation. And it's awful to imagine that they're doing this with the best of intentions. They're placing themselves in danger because they want to be the best daughters, mothers possible, etc. And yet here we find them in a situation that they could never have envisaged and imagined, even in their worst nightmares, meeting Jutting. And believe me, what happens to these women is straight out of a horror movie. So on the 24th of October 2014, Jutting brings Sumarti back to his apartment, and he's basically said to her, look, I've got loads of money, I'll give you a large sum of money if you come back and spend time with me. Now, for the first hour, it does seem that what took place there was consensual, but Jutting's been planning this for a while. You know, he's luring her into a false sense of security, and it doesn't take long for his true nature to just take over. And now he's got the perfect victim, the perfect person to just experiment on, to explore these depraved desires. And what Sumarti doesn't know is that he has been planning exactly what he's gonna do to her. He's got one intention. He's gonna keep her as a sex slave, and he is going to subject her to horrific torture. And he's already planned how. He's got a bell, he's got sex toys, he's got clamps, he's got a pair of pliers, and he's got his fists. At one point, he actually makes her go and collect his belt so that he can whip her with it. And again, that's power play psychologically. It's, you are mine now. Go and do what I say. Go and get that implement that you're going to now get hurt with. I'm going to hurt you with it, but you've brought it to me. He shaved her eyebrows off. He made her talk about her child back home in Indonesia, which must have just been incredible suffering for this woman, because this is the motivation as to why she's in this situation. And he's making her talk about her child. It's such a personal, intimate conversation. That's her child. And he wants her to know that he's intruding on that very sacred area. He kept Sumarti captive in that apartment for 3 days. And he videoed the abuse that he inflicted on her. I mean, he literally would sit there chillingly whilst videoing, talking in this really soft voice, all the while taunting her, all the while mutilating her. He claimed to beat her private parts so badly that she bled from her labia. And at one point when he was using his fist, which any female out there will know, it's a very few amount of people that would ever find that of any way, shape or form enjoyable. Most of us would balk at the idea, but the damage you can do, particularly when it's non-consensual, can be catastrophic. But he really doesn't care, because it isn't about her. And he actually makes her stay incredibly still, says to her, you enjoying it, tells her it's not that bad, says it's better than being beaten. And all the while, this poor girl is absolutely terrified. And the acts that he subjected to were horrific. So in one of the clips where he's recording himself, is saying, "I've never seen anyone that scared. She voluntarily ate feces out of the toilet. And then she just smiled at me afterwards. I urinated in her mouth. She threw up and I made her eat her own vomit. I made her take drugs." We're talking about a man talking about the terror of this poor young mum who's entered that situation believing she's going to walk away with some cash and isn't even going to walk away with her own life. And he's enjoying her suffering. He's really enjoying her suffering. It's just the worst imagined situation to ever consider being in. Finally, he takes her into the bathroom and he forces her to lick the dirty toilet bowl. And while she is bending over doing just that, because my God, she is fighting for her life. She is just complying because she wishes to make it out of that door at some point. While she's bending over doing that, he grabs her head and he repeatedly slashes her throat with a serrated knife. A serrated knife. By the time that he'd actually finished slashing her throat, he had almost decapitated her. And after the killing, he turns the camera on himself. He's naked. And he says, "My name is Ruik Jutting. About 5 minutes ago, I just murdered this woman in here. I held her captive. It's Monday. It was Saturday when I picked her up. I raped her repeatedly. I tortured her badly. Jesus Christ." Yeah, you can hear that the Jesus Christ is potentially a moment of reflection, a little bit of shock, but he's enjoying it. He's enjoying what he's done. And he has absolutely no intention of stopping. One thing he makes clear on his videos is now he's got a taste for blood. He's going to kill again. He doesn't see the victims as people. No, no. These victims are simply objects for his own pleasure. And he is happy to continue. In one video diary, he claims that he's at the start of a journey. Unless I'm caught. He even said, "At the end of the day, I'm going to go to jail for life. How many life sentences can one serve?" So as far as he's concerned, he thinks at some point I'm going to get caught. May as well kill again. In fact, the only remorse that he ever expressed wasn't for his murdered victim, but for the fact that he hadn't completed a deal for his employers. I mean, what is going on in that warped mind of his? He actually does describe himself accurately. At some point, he says he's a fucking evil psychopath. Well, yes, you are. We will all agree with that. And he also talks about after the killing how he didn't necessarily feel good or bad. He just felt hungry. Yeah. Having brutally raped, tortured, and murdered this young mother, he just wanted an ice cream. That denotes the psychopathic, narcissistic personality type we are dealing with right now. So as all of us will be aware, this guy is not going to stop. He's not going to stop unless he gets apprehended. He's got no intention. So we get to the 31st of October 2014. This is just a week. So he's had a cooling off period, guys. He's had a chance to reflect. He's had a chance to adjust his behaviour. He's had a chance to turn himself in because the realisation is what he's done is absolutely reprehensible and it's not changed him. Not at all. In fact, we only have a week, literally, after he's lured Samati back to his apartment on the 31st floor of that building, that he brings Seneng back. So just 7 days. He does this just after 45 minutes of meeting her. So clearly, she'll have been told, "Come back to my apartment, I'll pay you a lot of money, we'll have sex." And he's a Westerner. He's living in a really beautiful place. She's probably thinking to herself, "Oh, great. This isn't going to be bad. You know, this guy's Western. It's all going to be fine." She has literally no idea of the trap that she is walking into. And my God, again, this man has prepared. He knows exactly what he's going to do to her. He's actually got his kill kit ready. This comprised of zip ties, a blowtorch, hammer, nails, pins, sex toys wrapped in sandpaper. Honestly, I feel that when you get this kind of sexual sadist who's so comfortable to spend time in fantasy preparing these kind of murderous implements that as part of their guilty scenario, when they're actually apprehended, they should have to have them all used on them. I'm not saying that you would kill them, of course not. I'm not advocating murdering people who are perpetrators. I'm just saying, you know, how do they really understand the error of their ways unless somebody comes along and uses a zip ties, blowtorch, hammer, nails, pins and sex toys wrapped in sandpaper on them? Just feel like it would address the balance and redress it to a degree. I'm sure that quite a lot of you agree with that mindset that I have. Now, on a previous video entry that he'd actually talked about these implements, he said they weren't just for torture, but for the most inhumane torture possible. He's really thought about how he can cause the most agony to this poor, innocent girl. But the problem is, this fantasy isn't going to come off as he wants it to come off, because, as I always say, the thing about human beings is you can have a fantasy about them as much as you like, but they are damn unpredictable. And unpredictability means that no matter what your fantasy is or how great you think it's going to be, things don't always work out the way that you want. And that's exactly what plays out in this situation. So soon after arriving at the apartment, Seneng notices that there is a gag, and also she notices that that gag's been made from a condom and rope. And immediately she thinks this is not in context with what I've come for. So she starts to panic. She starts to scream. And you know, I have such absolute respect for this woman to have just noticed that and to think, no, I'm not going to put up with this. There is something really wrong. This is not what I've consented to. And to just lose it so that he knows that she's not going to consent. But even though she's screaming, even though she's trying to get away, he's obviously not happy with this. We know physically he's going to be way bigger than her. So he ends up just getting her to the floor and he just knifes her again and again. And she's stabbed so many times in the buttocks. She's stabbed in the neck. And she is fighting so hard. She's desperately trying to fend off this attack. She's screaming all the way throughout. But he is just perpetually attacking her, and he actually uses both hands to hack through her throat, and then he just leaves her dying on the floor. But something has tripped in his conscience, in his nature. I find it really intriguing when a victim breaks a killer's fantasy, because they are not playing their game and it changes the mindset of the individual. The failure to comply has an impact, and it certainly has an impact on Jutting. And after he leaves dying on the floor, he makes this video and it says, "I imagine this will be my last movie. This just happened." So again, he's saying something has changed, something has transitioned. There is something that has transcended his idea of what should happen versus the reality of what's occurred. And it's shifted his psyche. So he goes outside onto the balcony. At this point, bear in mind, he's covered in blood and he's just screaming at passers-by. And then he calls the police and he says something bad has happened. And at that point, he collapses on his balcony. So there's a real impact on this man's physiology, personality, character in that moment. And of course, the police go round and they don't know what they're going to find. They arrive thinking there's some Westerner potentially in trouble. But actually, no, they walk into a horror scene. Seneng is on the floor. She's critically injured. She's barely alive. And the paramedics are desperate to save her life. They want to save her. But it's obvious just by looking at Seneng that her throat has literally been so badly mutilated that the air pipes are visible through the slashes. And even though they make a valiant effort to save her, she dies in the apartment shortly after. Jutting is immediately arrested, of course he is, in the early hours of the 1st of November 2014, on suspicion of murder, because obviously he hasn't been tried, but clearly we all know he's definitely guilty of murder, and the officers will know that. And they start to do a search through his apartment to gather incriminating evidence. And they do, they find loads. So there's a number of objects, which includes a bloodstained knife. And if you think about the search and earlier attempts to save Seneng, everything is about gathering the evidence that points to bringing him to justice for her killing. But as they go around the apartment and they're taking their time, they want to get this guy. He's banged to rights already, but they want to make damn sure it's going to stick. They get to the balcony outside about an hour later, and there it is, a suitcase. And it just catches their attention. And when they open it, it's horrific because they discover the decomposing, maggot-ridden remains of Samati. She's wrapped in a blanket and plastic sheet. She's got a bag placed over her head, and then he'd tied her up with purple rope in a fetal position and just crammed her into the small black case. Even though they're not pathologists, they could see immediately the injuries were catastrophic. She had these knife injuries to her head, knife injuries to her throat. They could tell that her throat had been cut so severely that she was almost decapitated. Her head was literally hanging on by a small flap of cartilage. And wow, just like Sanang, they could see that this woman had fought for her life. She had so many defense wounds to her hands, to her arms, and to her wrists. She fought him. She tried to survive this nightmare attack. And I imagine that all the while she was just thinking, please let me see my child again. And he denied her that. When they start to interview this monster, Jutting doesn't actually try to deny the fact that he's liable for the crimes. Of course he can't. How are you going to say that somebody is in a suitcase on your balcony that you've clearly placed in that suitcase, and then you've had a period of time and you've gone out and killed another person? You can't ever suggest for one minute that you're not the responsible party. And he apparently said, yes, I did kill her. I cut her throat. He also tells them, look, I want to reassure you that these are the only two people that I killed, because I imagine the police are thinking this is definitely a serial killer. And he is, isn't he? When we think about the definition of a serial killer, it's two or more individuals merged with the cooling off period in between. And that's what's happened here. So I imagine they were really concerned that there could be other bodies elsewhere. They then start to forensically analyze his mobile technology. And what they find is just horrific, even for the most hardened of investigators. They see 72 images of Samati's torture, of her death. In one of them, Jutting is literally holding up her head with his hand. That's after he's slashed her throat in the shower. Also, there were 4 hours, 4 hours of chilling video material, including footage which followed Samati's killing. And he's consuming things like large quantities of cocaine, alcohol. He's going on and on about the graphic contents of her rape, of her torture, of a murder, of the immense sexual gratification that it had given him. And as he's doing this, as he's talking about this in video, and you can actually see Samati's body in the background, face down near the toilet. I mean, the dehumanization, the objectification of the body, the domination, all of this playing out in real time on that video, it's just truly catastrophic to imagine the impact that this would have on the families of those killed. In one of the videos, he says, I just killed someone. First person I killed. I cut her throat in the bathroom, to be precise. I cut her throat while she was bending over, licking the dirty toilet bowl. I treated her as a non-person, as a sex object. And that turned me on. Ugh, it's just grotesque beyond belief. Grotesque beyond belief. In another clip, Jutting's heard saying, my destiny is to push the boundaries of complete and utter inhumanity. Again, a statement that I think we should reflect on him in the treatment of him when he's incarcerated. I would like that, to push the boundaries of complete and utter inhumanity on an individual so comfortable doing the same to others. Also, when they're going through his electronic devices, they find an out-of-office auto-reply email. You know, the ones that you set up when you're out at work, somewhere that you can't respond to things, or where you're having a holiday. Here's read, I am out of the office indefinitely. For urgent inquiries, or indeed any inquiries, please contact someone who is not an insane psychopath. I mean, I will say something, it is at least an accurate depiction of the individual that we are describing. Although the insane bit, not buying that. Not buying that at all. A little bit too organised to be insane, mate. Now, they had medical experts, of course, look at Jutting, and four agreed that he had narcissistic personality. I don't think you need an expert to tell you that. His actions equate that reality. So when they're talking about narcissistic personality, I think it's really important because we talk about narcissism a great deal in our society. We talk about an increase in narcissism in young people because of things like social media. We talk about narcissistic partners. We talk about narcissistic parents. And it's good to have that discussion. It really is. But it doesn't define true narcissism. When you're talking about narcissistic personality disorder, it is such a dramatic diagnosis to some degree, because what it entails is a real inflated sense of self-importance and a complete lack of empathy for others. So people can have elements of narcissism, they can have personality traits that kind of become part of that spectrum, but they're not pure narcissists. This guy is a pure narcissist, and his actions absolutely evidence that. I think we can use the term narcissism a little bit too much these days, and it dilutes the true danger of an individual who truly is pure narcissistic in their behaviour. Now, shortly before Jutting's actual trial, his parents end up selling the family home and they actually get divorced. This is after 32 years of being married, and they've been a successful relationship. So you can imagine that that's got to be, in my mind at least, a direct consequence of the stress that the son's criminal investigation has been having on them. I think that in situations like that, you're always looking to blame yourself or somebody else because it's too much to manage. So you get into situations where you're like, what did I do wrong? And that can be very draining for a partner. And equally, you can be like, what did you do wrong? And that can cause massive stress and conflict in a relationship. But it's a real sad end for them. You know, they've been really successful together. And we all have pains and problems in our relationships, but for this couple, it feels like that's the tipping point. That's the hair that breaks the camel's back. Then we get to the murder trial. This begins on the 24th of October, 2016. So this is 2 years after the killings. And Jutting pleads not guilty to the murders. Mate, what? I'm not guilty. We literally have you on video being guilty, but I'm not guilty because just like my lecturers and examiners in my degree, it turns out that you think I'm guilty, but actually you're too stupid to understand why I'm not guilty. You're guilty, you're on video, you literally tell people that you are responsible, therefore you are definitely guilty. It could be the case that I was guilty if I hadn't been out of my mind. Remember that out of office email where I say I'm an insane psychopath? Well, I've decided to drop the psychopath bit and just go for the insane. I see what you're doing there and I see where you're going with it. It's not going to work, kid, no matter how stupid you think I am. That's, I imagine, the conversation that should have transpired during that moment. But yeah, he's like, no, I'm not guilty. It's manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Yes, I do admit that I did prevent the lawful burial of a body, but at the end of the day, I definitely wasn't responsible in those moments. So of course, his lawyer was like, what are we gonna do with this case, guys? Seriously, that's what it would be like. The defense lawyer would be like, right, guys, we have this case. It's this Western guy. He spent $650,000 on drugs and alcohol and sex for 2 years. He's an individual who's literally videoed himself murdering the women and been very, very forthcoming with the reasoning why. And he's had lots of time to reflect on those actions and killed a second victim. So I'm thinking we can't suggest he didn't do it because it's on video. But what we could suggest is he didn't really know he was doing it. You can imagine all the people in the legal office just looking going, yeah, that's a great idea. That's going to be dead effective. He's definitely, definitely, definitely going to get off with that. But you got to get a defense right. So his lawyer's like, yeah, look, listen, There's no doubt he killed both his victims and that he'd actually known what he was doing during and after, and in fact before the killings. But even though he did know all that, Jutting's mind just wasn't normal at the time. So shall we just unravel that defence? So your defence is that he knew exactly what he was doing before, during and after the commission of the crime. Yes, absolutely. He knew exactly what he was doing before, during and after the crime. And that's why he was able to quite explicitly explain his actions, reactions and consequences of those reactions on video. Exactly. Exactly that. You're getting it exactly right. So how would that mean that he was not compos mentis? Well, because of all the drugs and alcohol, even though he knew exactly what he was doing before, during and after, we're saying he didn't actually know what he was doing before, during and after, even though he did know what he was doing before, during and after, because it's on video. But what we're saying is he didn't know what he was doing before, during and after. Have you ever worked as an examiner for Cambridge? Sorry, just can't get my head around how that's a defence. But that's what they're going to do. He wasn't in control of his actions because of his excessive use of drugs and alcohol. The prosecution are like, yeah, no, he's just totally guilty of murder. He planned both of his killings. He had his torch kit, his kill kit. Also, he'd been really quiet, calm. He'd been in control throughout. Bear in mind, he wasn't screaming uncontrollably at this girl when he was murdering her. He was constantly taunting her, using that soft voice, etc. And arguably, this is an individual whose character has for a long period of time sustained drugs and alcohol as part of his normal MO. And yet he hasn't gone around murdering loads of people before. He's got to a point in a position where he's pushed the boundaries so much, he's been ready and prepared and planned and in fantasy for a period of time, and then has gone ahead and actually carried out these killings. So the prosecution have got a really strong case. So we get to November 2016, there was a jury of 5 men and 4 women, and they're like, no, your diminished responsibility defence can do one, mate. So they all find him unanimously guilty of 2 counts of murder. He's 31 at that point. And apparently when they read the verdict, he showed literally no emotion. Of course he didn't. He's a major narcissistic psychopath. Emotion is something that he fails to be hardwired with. That's the reality, isn't it? It's the same as when his mother said, oh, I'm really glad that you've got your scholarship. And this kid is like, how dare you underestimate me? He's not got the right reaction base. And certainly when he finds out that his life has been taken from him to some degree as far as freedom is concerned, he just doesn't react at all. And he actually ends up being sentenced to 2 life terms. Now, following the sentencing, Jutting, of course, decides that he's going to express his remorse for his crimes. And even though some people might think, well, okay, at the end of the day, it's good that he's showing remorse, I will tell you, I do not believe he has a tiny amount of remorse in his entire body. Now, following his sentencing, Jutting actually goes ahead and expresses the remorse for his crimes, as if anyone is going to believe that this individual has even a millimetre of remorse in his entire body. But this is what he says. I remain haunted daily, both by memory of my actions and by knowledge of the acute pain I have caused their loved ones, not least Samata's young son. The evil I have done cannot be remedied by me in words or actions. Nevertheless, for whatever it may be worth, to Samata's family and friends, and Seneng's family and friends, I am sorry. I am sorry beyond words. That sounds like it's been written by some B-grade soap. Genuinely, it's just so insincere. Literally, there is such insincerity. And let's not forget the way that he starts it. I remain haunted daily, both by memory of my actions and knowledge of the acute pain I have caused their loved ones. He's basically saying it upsets him. I'm really sorry that I murdered your family. I want you to know It really upsets me. And of course, I'm the most important person in the world, so you should know how much pain I'm having to endure because of what I did to you. Anyway, the judge refuses to accept this and actually said, you didn't show any remorse in the trial. I don't buy into this at all. And the reason that we all know that Jutting is a major psychopathic liar is because if he believed what he just said, you'd be like, lock me up, throw away the key. In fact, give me some of that torture equipment that I created so I can use it on myself because I'm a disgusting, reprehensible human being who needs to suffer. That would be the reaction if you were so torn up by your guilt. But no, he just appeals both of his sentences. So he wants to get out. It's as simple as that. He couldn't care less about the victim. It's all about his freedom. And he's kind of setting the scene by saying that at the court hearing so that people go, oh, is he really that bad? Maybe it was the drugs and alcohol. No, he really is that bad. Now, photographs from prison, they actually showed that after a couple of years, he'd lost a lot of weight. Obviously, he's not getting alcohol, he's not getting the drugs, he's not getting the bad food takeaways. So 2 years in prison food has slimmed him out a great deal. So in February 2018, his application for appeal was rejected by the Hong Kong Appeal Court. And like I said, that happens twice. Fortunately, now he's got very long time to reflect on the decisions that basically landed him in a foreign prison. And by the way, the prison, yeah, I looked it up. It's got some of the most violent, notorious criminals that you could imagine, all incarcerated in the maximum security Stanley Prison. And a little additional feature to this Stanley Prison is that life for Westerners there is notoriously tough, especially for Westerners who've killed women. I think that we can all agree that we can only hope that his fellow inmates show him the same respect and mercy that he showed his victims. I'm sure his pampered and privileged upbringing with his private education and all the care and compassion he was given by his parents will have set him up in good stead for his life inside. I think he'll just be fine, won't he? He won't have any problems. But I could also say and see that potentially there might be a few issues that he'll meet. You know, sexual sadists, they aren't celebrated in these places. And often certain prisoners feel that maybe the best way to treat these kind of killers is to give them a taste of their own medicine. We can only imagine that possibility playing out. Of course, even if that isn't the case, and somehow he miraculously gets through his incarceration unscathed, well, it's only temporary, because we all know where he's heading after he takes his last breath. And he certainly won't be needing any clothes, because it's going to be really, really, really hot down there. This case is one of those that I hope I have at least illuminated a little bit further for you. Like I said, I know it well. I hope I've told you some information that you didn't know. The horror that families have endured is just incalculable. Those poor girls who were just trying to make a better life for themselves, snuffed out in the way that they were snuffed out. It's incomprehensible to imagine those last moments. I genuinely wish this man nothing but pain. He was quite happy to ensure that those individuals that sadly came within his clutches were not allowed any mercy. And so too, neither should he have any. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.